When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
On this week's Wealth Track, investment lessons from a great investor. In a rare interview, T. Rowe Price's Brian Rogers shares 35 years of experience, 30 at the helm of the award-winning Equity Income Fund. Next on Consuelo Mack, Wealth Track.
New York Life, along with Mainstay's family of mutual funds, offers investment and retirement solutions so you can help your clients keep good going.
Additional funding provided by Thornburg Investment Management,
Active Management, Flexible Perspective,
Rosalind P. Walter, and the Fairholme Foundation.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Wealth Track. I'm Consuelo Mack. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to interview some of the most successful investors in the business, including Warren Buffett. They are all quite different, but they definitely share some personality traits. I was reminded of one of them when interviewing this week's guest and when reading Mr. Buffett's most recent letter to shareholders. One common characteristic is optimism. The 86-year-old Buffett has it in spades. If anything, he seems to be getting more upbeat with age. Here's what he says about the investment environment in America. Our efforts to materially increase the normalized earnings of Berkshire will be aided, as they have been throughout our managerial tenure, by America's economic dynamism. One word sums up our country's achievements: miraculous. From a standing start 240 years ago, a span of time less than triple my days on Earth, Americans have combined human ingenuity, a market system, a tide of talented and ambitious immigrants, and the rule of law to deliver abundance beyond any dreams of our forefathers. He goes on to say, above all, it's our market system, an economic traffic cop ably directing capital, brains, and labor, that has created America's abundance. Yes, the buildup of wealth will be interrupted for short periods from time to time. It will not, however, be stopped. I'll repeat what I've both said in the past and expect to say in future years. Babies born in America today are the luckiest crop in history. Well, no one alive, at least that we know of, has matched Buffett's 50-plus year investment returns, but this week's guest has racked up an impressive 30-year record with less than market risk, as well as shepherding a highly respected investment firm safely through some turbulent times, including the financial crisis. He is Brian Rogers, now non-executive chairman of the board of T. Rowe Price, a firm he joined as a portfolio manager in 1982. Until recently, he was the firm's chairman and chief investment officer. In 2015, 30 years after launching the award-winning T. Rowe Price Equity Income Fund, he handed the reins over to a co-portfolio manager. During his tenure, its 10.7% annualized returns just about matched the S&P 500's 10.8% performance, but it did so with less volatility than the market, offering more protection during market declines. Over the past 20 years and under his leadership, 85% of the firm's funds outperformed their benchmarks over multiple rolling 5- and 10-year periods. Now, Rogers is a regular member of the prestigious Barron's Annual Investment Roundtable and was recently recruited to join the board overseeing Harvard's endowment, as he puts it, helping out the university where he received his undergraduate and business degrees. I asked Rogers to share some of the most important lessons learned from 35 years of managing money and building a firm. We started with being an optimist.
Well, as an investor, Consuelo, you want to think about the future. You have to appreciate that the long-term trend of economic growth is upward. There are 7 billion people in the world, more or less. They all want a better life for themselves and their children. And the progress of economies generally is from south to north over the long term, and there are many interruptions along the way. But being optimistic about the future is one of, the basic ground rules for being an equity investor. You have to have confidence in the future. You have to assume a company will be able to grow. If you invest in the company, you'll benefit from that growth. And that's why I always feel like investors have to be optimists.
So through, you know, the 30 years that you're running the equity income fund, I mean, there were some, you know, major crises. I mean, one of them being the financial crisis of 8 years ago. And how do you apply that optimism during periods when everyone feels around you feels that the world is falling apart?
Well, you try not to panic in the short term. And over any 30 or 35 year period, there are a lot of ups and downs.
Right.
And in the heat of the moment, in the heat of 2008, the one thing I always like to look back on and dust off, if you will, was Jeremy Siegel's book, Stocks for the Long Run.
Yes.
Because that gives you that long-term perspective that is really crucial for an investor to buy into.
Now, he's been criticized a lot for that, you know, book since then, because obviously there have been periods when stocks for the long run didn't pay off in a 5, 6, 7, even a 10-year period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in our relatively short lifetimes, how do you handle those periods when actually stocks don't do well?
Well, we had the so-called lost decade from 2000 to maybe 2010, if you will. And think what happened in that period. You had the dot-com bubble and crash. You had the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression. And you basically broke even. And so if you can have two serious periods such as those and still break even, that's probably speaks to having a good long-term case.
Okay.
And so you have to think longer term, even when the days are dark.
So, Brian, speaking of optimism, looking back at your track record at the Equity Income Fund, 10.7% annualized returns, terrific track record. A lot of pros on Wall Street are saying don't expect those returns in the future. What is your view?
Well, I think the future is a long period of time, obviously.
Right.
I think over the next several years, I don't think investors will make 10.7% a year, whatever the number is. We're starting in early 2017 from an elevated level of valuation. It's likely short-term interest rates and intermediate-term interest rates move up over the next year or two, thus compressing the levels of market valuation. And I think investors probably ought to be happy if they earn 6 to 8% a year for the next 5 years. The long-term rate of return from investing in equities is between 10 and 11%. But coming from current valuation levels, returns tend to be less robust.
Which leads me to another lesson that you've learned, and that is that everything is cyclical. And so explain in retrospect why you can take advantage of cyclicality and that, in fact, that crises are opportunities. It's a very contrarian point of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always been a contrarian investor, maybe a contrarian person. So when you look long term at the pace, at the rate of growth in the economy globally, it tends to follow a wave-like pattern. Now, interestingly, since 2009, we've been in a period of positive economic growth, albeit sluggish economic growth. So today begs the question, where are we right now in the in the context of long-term cyclicality? And we're probably approaching a period of economic maturity. So maybe the next cyclical move at some point is going to be downward. In periods of economic crisis, usually they coincide with periods of market crisis. And that's oftentimes when you want to tighten your belt and make investment decisions on the buy side. Acknowledging that over the long term, that positive rate of economic growth will resume at some point. And even in the darkest days of 1981, 82, and 1991, and 2001, 2002, obviously 2008, 2009, you could almost always make a going concern assumption that the economy at some point would snap back. All the policymakers work to do it, our political leaders, our central bankers, our business leaders, and so you know there will always be a rebound whenever there's a downturn.
But right now, we're kind of at the, as you said, where it's a mature economy. We've had an 8-year bull market. I mean, another lesson that you've learned as well is that price matters a lot, that you've written that it's a determinant of investment success.
Well, it's probably not a time to be aggressively bullish. A lot of changes going on in Washington, a lot of policy implications, a lot of economic implications of the new administration. From a valuation standpoint, let's look around markets. Money market funds yielding 1-ish%. The 10-year Treasury yielding 2.5%. Dividend yield on the S&P 500, about 2%. What will the growth rate in that dividend be over the next 5 or 10 years? So my suspicion is we're in for a period of relatively low rates of return across asset classes. Money market assets will be safe but low yielding. The credit markets have been in a 35-year bull market, more or less, And in my view, it's highly likely that the next 5 or 10 years is going to be more challenging for fixed income assets. With rising rates, what does that mean for market multiples from a PE, price earnings ratio standpoint? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I feel like the upside potential from the equity market is more subdued than it's been traditionally. And investors face the challenge of being satisfied with earning maybe 6, 7, or 8% a year as opposed to 10, 12, 15% a year like has been the case over various periods in time. So we're in a low inflation, low return era is my hunch.
So still low inflation, low return. I mean, people are very excited about the Trump agenda. They're likening it to the Reagan era. What is your take on that interpretation of where we are?
Well, I think the easy part was winning the election and the inauguration. Now comes the hard part, getting a series of legislative policies approved in Congress, mm-hmm. tax reform, corporate tax reform, repatriation, an infrastructure bill. We're going to have to wait and see what all this means. And I think investors have been very positively inclined since the election. And it's harder to do than it is to talk about.
Which leads me to another lesson learned, which is that you've said investment humility is important, that it's important for investors to be humble, and that that overconfidence is an investor's greatest challenge. Why is that?
Well, I think when investors are overconfident about an asset class or a given security,
Or a market,
they are willing to pay more for it. Their analysis tends to be a little less rigorous. I think I always tell our younger investors that we don't know as much as we think we know. Because when you come out of graduate school and you hit your ground running on Wall Street, you think you know everything. And being overconfident is really the enemy of good investment returns over the long term.
How have you protected yourself against becoming overconfident? Or, I mean, have you made mistakes along the way that it has taught you, you know, Brian?
Consuelo, we don't have enough time to talk about all of my mistakes. But I think observing people making investment errors when you're young really leaves an indelible mark on you. And whether you do it yourself or you observe others, I think a thorough reading of economic history grounds you and prevents you from becoming a little too overconfident. Reading about others' mistakes. Every day in the Wall Street Journal is a new story about a fund or a small company or something else that's getting into trouble. And you learn a lot from that. You learn a lot from watching the mistakes of others, and hopefully you learn more from their mistakes than from your own.
So what's interesting is that you describe yourself as an optimist, you know, which you are as an investor. But there is a cube on your desk that evidently says, doubt everything, believe nothing. That sounds very cynical to me.
I think investors get into trouble sometimes when they hear an investment story or an investment case and they just buy it hook, line, and sinker.
Right.
That specific item on my desk is because one time the CEO of a utility company came into our office and said, our dividend is 100% safe. And 3 months later, the company cut its dividend. So doubt everything, believe nothing.
Right.
Be skeptical when you hear very bullish arguments and cases, and be a little bit wary of very flamboyant, very compelling stories.
Which is another one of your lessons learned. You just say avoid the it stocks, kind of the cult investments. That's along those same lines. If there is an it stock, if there is a cult investment, then your guard should be up. Is that right?
Yeah, I think any company that gets too much publicity, mm-hmm. That is always on the front page, you have to be a little bit wary about that. The woman who coined the phrase it stock was talking about Enron mm-hmm. 18 years ago.
Right.
And it was the it stock. You had to own it. Everybody believed it. Everybody was overweighted in it. Everybody wrote positively about it. And look what happened. And there are always examples of that in markets, both in equity markets and also in fixed income and other markets, commodities markets. In today, it doesn't feel as though we have any specific cases of irrational exuberance. It's just more that the overall market is expensive.
Right.
I would have said 2 years ago, the biotech sector, there was a lot of crazy stuff going on there. And the investor would have been well served to look at all of that frenzy and take a step back.
What about the FANG stocks? So, you know, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, which actually dominated the market in 2015.
They sold off a little bit last year. They weren't.
I mean, is that kind of a craze?
Those handful of companies are doing very well fundamentally.
Okay.
The question the investor has to ask is how much is priced in? I mean, we all use Amazon. We all love Amazon. We're probably all on Facebook. I'm a relatively new Facebook user. But you have to ask yourself, what is the valuation the company's selling at, and what assumptions are built into its earnings outlook? And in some cases, you can make an argument that some of those companies are extended valuation-wise.
Do you want to make the argument?
I would say they're somewhat expensive.
Right.
At the same time, when fundamental earnings performance is strong, or fundamental revenue performance in the case of some of the companies without earnings, they're gaining share. They're doing very well fundamentally. So you want to be a little bit careful. One of my friends was a Wall Street strategist, and he often talked about how he had five generations of friends and hedge funds who lost their careers shorting Amazon. So when a company is doing well fundamentally, even if it's expensive, you don't necessarily want to make an extreme statement against it or extreme bet against it.
Brian, as a value investor, a contrarian investor, are there some stocks like an Amazon, for instance, or a Facebook or a Google that are so dominant that we all should own in our portfolios? I mean, is there a compelling case to be made that there are just some stocks that companies that look like, you know, you should own them even though they're not a great value now or they're not a contrarian bet?
Yeah, I think there are very few companies, Consuelo, I would say one holds forever.
Right.
When I look at my career over 30 years, my money management career
management
over 30 years,
right.
There were probably 3 or 4 out of 100 at the end that I had owned at the beginning.
Right. Did you know that going in? I mean,
no,
did
I didn't
you
know
recognize
that going in. I mean, one would have been the, one was Exxon.
Right. Which you owned for 30
forever.
Years.
One
right.
was basically the predecessor company of J.P. Morgan, which you can all trace back to commercial credit in Baltimore back in 1985, 86.
Johnson & Johnson, because I had actually asked you about this.
Yeah, Johnson & Johnson was probably the other one
we had. And again, that's equity income fund. Those are dividend payers. That was a classic, the kind of companies that you wanted to own in the equity income fund. They represented that.
The perfect investment for us, Consuelo, was always a company whose stock price goes up, obviously.
Right.
Whose dividend goes up at least the same pace. Therefore, their dividend yield stays exactly the same, just at a higher price with a higher dividend. And that was always the perfect series of investments. But that's a relatively small number out of hypothetically 100 holdings in the equity income fund.
Yeah.
So that's why I say there are very few companies you can buy and hold forever.
Mm-hmm.
Warren Buffett would say maybe, Coca-Cola might have been one or whatever, but there are very few companies that fit that bill.
Active versus passive debate. It seems like we've reached a critical turning point where, passive has really taken off, and in a low return environment, people are looking very closely at fees. Has passive won that debate?
Well, I think passive has won the fee debate.
Mm-hmm,
hasn't necessarily won the performance debate.
Right.
I think when I think back to 1982 when I joined T. Rowe Price, the share of passive in total U.S. mutual fund assets was probably single-digit percent.
Right.
Now it's probably a third.
And growing rapidly.
Huge growth. Growing very rapidly over the last couple of years. The more money that's invested passively, the better skilled active investors can do. Because as correlations rise and the same money pours into an index, specifically the S&P 500, the opportunities to cherry pick and excel will increase over time.
Mm-hmm.
And probably one of the most fertile areas would be S&P companies 501 to 1,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Arguing if all of the money is flowing into the S&P 500, from plain old passive funds, passive mutual funds, passive ETFs, arguably that sector or that part of the marketplace, which is very large, will be valued much more highly than it might otherwise be, and there might be arbitrage opportunities to invest elsewhere. Active management is really hard, and we've done a lot of work looking at our company.
Right.
And we think we've done it very well over time.
Mm-hmm. No, and I said in my introduction to you that 85% of the T. Rowe Price funds, you've looked back at the last 20 years, over 5 and 10-year rolling periods, have actually outperformed their benchmarks, right?
And 100% of our asset allocation funds.
Okay.
Target date funds, retirement date funds.
Right.
So you can do it. You can do it well. The issue becomes, what are investor preferences? And will every investor in the world decide to invest passively? And if we're the last active manager standing, we will thrive. We won't be the last one standing. There'll be others. But it's our game will be easier as more and more money flows passively.
So let me go back to the 85% of your funds outperforming their benchmark. Can you pick those ahead of time? Of course, I'm thinking with, you know, with my luck, I'll be in the 15% that didn't. Mm-hmm. But are there determining factors that you can actually spot as an investor investing in a fund that you can tell, you know, this fund is probably going to do pretty well over the long term?
Yeah, I think it's hard to identify the 15 that won't.
Right.
And I think looking at the 85 that did, the 85% that did, in advance, it's hard to do that. And so there's a probabilistic assessment you have to make. Are you willing to take that chance?
Right.
That you'll be in the 85, not the 15. You know, I think 85% odds are pretty good odds. If you think of the odds of investing in anything generally, or the
right.
odds of playing baseball or kicking field goals or anything mm-hmm. else. So 85% probability are pretty good odds. And we think we have a culture and an organization in place to perpetuate that. But there are no guarantees.
Right. So, the major argument for the advocates of passive investing is that, number one, they're very tax efficient because you're investing in an index which isn't being actively managed. And also that the fees are so low, that it is such a high bar for active investors to surpass that. You know, I mean, what's your response to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, our response is look at our company and look at our data.
Right. Yep.
And again, there are no guarantees prospectively, but the opportunity to earn a higher return mm-hmm. than an index, if realized, can have a very really positive effect on the investor's fortunes.
Yep.
And even if it's a 50 basis points or a percent a year over a long period of time, that can really be of great benefit to the investor. And that's really the case we make to our clients and customers.
Right. But you think there can be a role for passive investing for investors.
Absolutely.
Would you assign that role?
And we are not religious on this debate. Mm-hmm. We have a passive fund business at T. Rowe Price. It's a small part of our business
right.
relative to our active business. Mm-hmm. But we offer index fund products
right.
for defined contribution investors and others. And so it's really a matter of the individual investor's preference. And what does he or she want?
Mm-hmm.
And is he or she content with an index return? And that's fine. The individual investor in that case might not want to look at funds and might not want to know who manages the fund and how's the fund done in up and down markets. And some investors would just as soon make that easy decision, and that's fine, and we can do that for people.
Mm-hmm.
There are many other investors who want to do better, and we really cater to that marketplace.
I last interviewed you in December of 2013, and at that time, you were asking the question, what if nothing is cheap? Well, 3 years later, nothing is really cheap as far as if you look at the markets. The markets are much higher than they were back then. So what's your response to that? What do you do if nothing is cheap?
If nothing is cheap, you can't be wholly opposed to holding cash or very short duration fixed income securities. You know, there was interest rate risk at the long end of the fixed income market, but in the very short term maturity range, you can invest very safely and defensively there.
And speaking of not being cheap, the equity income fund, one of the things that you traditionally look for were undervalued dividend payers. Is there any such animal out there now, an undervalued dividend payer?
Yeah, I think it's a little harder this year than it's been over the last couple of years because there has been a big move to seek out income.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And you've seen it in the fixed income market, but you've also seen it in the equity market, where high-yielding stocks have been in great demand. And so I think it's a little bit tougher for my colleague John Lenihan, who manages the Equity Income Fund mm-hmm. now. But there are interesting companies out there selling at attractive levels of valuation. You know, Total and Chevron, two high-yielding energy stocks, very high quality. You can construct a portfolio with Merck and UPS and companies of that ilk yielding 3 to 3.2%, much higher than the yield you get on a 10-year treasury.
Right.
So there are still pockets of opportunity, but I think the market overall is more extended than it was at our last conversation a couple of years ago. And so that would argue for a bit more caution going forward.
Right. Final question. One investment for a long-term diversified portfolio. What should we all own something of?
Well, we just talked about how hard that is.
Yes, we certainly did.
And I'm going to mention two because I want to diversify. And I'd mention two companies, both investments at T. Rowe Price. Bristol-Myers Squibb, mm-hmm. A leading company in terms of introducing new immunotherapy strategies battling different types of cancer. I have firsthand knowledge that their products work.
Mm-hmm.
And the company sells at a reasonably attractive level of valuation. They had a little earnings miss a couple of months ago, but the company long-term is going to do great, and in 20 years, they'll be curing more people than they cure today. The second is Walt Disney.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
A company I've had an investment in for a long, long period of time, and in 20 or 25 years, we will all be taking our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren or whatever to Disney World. The daily pass at Disney World will probably, I don't even know what it's going to cost in 25 years.
Right.
But it's a company with irreplaceable assets, a unique position, huge moats around its business, and is a long-term winner in almost any dimension.
All right. So two win investments. What a bonus from
there you go.
Brian Rogers. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your lessons learned over a wonderful 35-year career.
Consuelo, my pleasure. Thank you.
At the close of every Wealth Track, we try to give you one suggestion to help you build and protect your wealth over the long term. This week's action point is add humility to the qualities you look for in a money manager and his or her firm. Investing is a humbling profession. Even the top practitioners make mistakes or can be upended by the markets. You want managers who recognize the risks, are able to minimize them, and acknowledge errors when made. I hope you can tune in next week. We're going to change course and focus on strategies to create income in retirement. Two retirement planning experts will share some overlooked strategies. To hear more of our interview with Brian Rogers about how he made the decision to scale back at T. Rowe Price and take on some other challenges that interest him, click on the extra feature on our website, wealthtrack.com. Also, let us know what you think of what we're doing by contacting us on Facebook or Twitter. Have a great weekend and make the week ahead a profitable and a productive one.
New York Life, along with Mainstay's family of mutual funds, offers investment and retirement solutions so you can help your clients keep good going.
Additional funding provided by Thornburg Investment Management, Active Management, Flexible Perspective, Rosalind P. Walter, and the Fairholme Foundation.